He probably has the largest collection of Hawaiian shirts in Western Canada, and he's known for the weather window and wishing people their 100th birthday greetings. Wayne Cox is behind the microphone with me today. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Wayne, you started quite a few years ago, 1968, I believe it was. How did you first become interested in being a broadcaster? How old were you then, and how did you get your foot in the door?
Well, the interest, I think, just came from, it wasn't a natural progression, but in high school, I was always involved in skits and talent shows and emceeing things, and then we had a little radio report, I think it was once a week or something, over the PA system, and just giving the kids, you know, what was coming up. And so that was a bit of a flavor of it, and then I remember reading an article by Johnny Carson, I think. I was a big fan of Johnny Carson and Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin, all those variety shows, where he said he got his start in radio. The big key to the radio was to learn how to read out loud. So he would read everything he'd get his hands on, newspapers, magazines, even though they're not written to be read aloud, it was just the process of word after word. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. So I ran into this in the basement of CKLG, National Institute of Broadcasting. Frank Callahan, who was the program director at CKLG, would run this nightly, or once a week, at least our class was. And it was essentially a correspondence course. You got these records by a guy named Peter Jackson. Only because his name was the same as the cigarettes. Whether his name was Peter Jackson, I don't think so. Anyway, you got script to follow along with this guy on the record, and then you'd buy a little tape machine and you'd try and do what he was doing. So that went on for a while, and it was interesting. And then one night, Frank Callahan came downstairs and he said, "We're starting this new radio station, CKLG-FM, that was doing Lester Lannan plays Broadway to Hollywood and Ronnie Aldrich and the Twin Pianos. We're going to go underground rock and roll. And it's the only underground rock station north of San Francisco and west of Toronto. And we need some operators. Anybody want in?" Well, I couldn't get my hand up fast enough because I knew it represented actually working in a radio station. Oh, yeah, and it was a dollar an hour. Quit whenever you want. So I shot my hand up. I was one. Bob Morris, he turned out, he wasn't in the class, but he turned out he was going to be an operator too, even though he had been on the air somewhere else. And it was a great opportunity to work with people, not work like buddies, pals, but to be around John Tanner and Daryl B. And Terry David Mulligan was like the music director. And the most important thing was it gave me access to the production room when everyone went home. So at midnight, when J.B. Shane was on the AM side, I would gather up a huge music library to choose from. I had all these old scripts, all these old commercials that were in the production room, and I would put a reel on, and I would just pretend radio all night long and rewind the tape and listen, you know, do the whole thing, until I thought I had a decent tape that I could send out to try and get a job on air, because we weren't on the air. We were just running tapes and running records. So that was the beginning, and the first on-air job was in Quesnel, CKCQ, but that was how I got my foot in the door. Other people at that time were starting to go to BCIT. That was 1968, 67, 68 in there. And I didn't have the qualifications to go to BCIT, nor the money. So it became, instead of 2 years at school, I said, okay, I'm going to invest 2 years and I'm going to be learning as I go. Small town, that kind of thing. And it worked out great.
So you got a job in Quesnel.
Yep.
You sent your tape up there, and they said, come on up.
Well, it was an unfortunate situation, sort of, but timing is everything. I went and canoed the Bowron Lakes with some friends, and to get to the Bowron Lakes, you have to go by Quesnel. And as I'm listening to this radio station, I'm listening to the people who are on the air, I thought, well, I don't know, I could do that. You know, I think I sound as good as that, so I shipped them a tape. It just so happened when they got my tape, one of the guys, one of the on-air guys, was killed in a car crash. So all of a sudden, they were short a guy. So they said, well, if you can get up here, we'll have a little talk with you. So that morning, I got up with a buddy. We jumped in the old Chevy 2 Nova, and away we went up the canyon and had the interview, turned around, and drove right back again. So it was like an 18-hour, 19-hour drive. And then I got the word that I got the job, and I was absolutely thrilled. Yeah.
What was your first job in Quesnel?
In Quesnel was the evening show, and I think I started at, it was either 6 or something like that, 6 till 11. And then I pulled the plug on the transmitter. That was the end of the broadcast day. And Denny Reed was the general manager. Gil McCall was the program director. He also ran a show. I asked the two of them, I said, why am I pulling the plug? The transmitter's right in the control room. Why am I pulling the plug on the transmitter at 11? You know, 12 would seem like a, if you're going to sign off. And they said, well, the last guy who did the shift, he thought 12 was a little too late. He couldn't make it to the parties. So we moved it back to 11. And you know who was doing the morning show when I was there? You ever hear of a guy named Peter Weisbeck, the talk show guy? He was at that time Peter Weston, and he was the morning show guy, you know, running records and doing the thing and everything. And he was only there about a month or two while I was there, and then boom, he was gone, and I didn't run into him again until he was Peter Weisbeck, I think at CJOR, when he surfaced years and years later.
What were you playing at that time?
That was a culture shock, because I went from LGFM, underground rock and roll, doing, you know, 27-minute cuts of Jimi Hendrix or Paul Butterfield Blues Band, to country and western. And this is the old stuff. This is the Porter Wagoner, early Willie Nelson when he used to wear a shirt and a tie. It was, as far as I can remember, it was just prior, I think. Yeah, just prior to Canadian content coming in. And when it did, we were absolutely flat-footed. We just, what, huh? 30%? There wasn't 30% in our record library. So Snowbird got played to death, right? All those white albums, the Canadian...
Talent Library.
Rob McConnell and the Boss Brass and these people, never heard of them, you know. But we had to, you know, as you probably remember, you all of a sudden had to come up with this content. That was a struggle. But going from this underground rock to Porter Wagoner and early Dolly Parton, I thought, gee, what did I get myself into here? But I ended up loving it. It was just another experience. And that whole 13 months in Quesnel was the most fun and probably the most interesting, because you got to do everything. Unplug the transmitter, and by the time I left, I was plugging it in, doing the morning show. You got to read sports and news. You emptied the garbage can and the ashtrays. That'll tell you how long ago it was, emptying ashtrays. So you got to do the whole thing. And the only reason I stayed 13 months was when I was at LG, there was a newsman named Bren Traff. And Bren told me, when I was so excited I got this job, he said, look it, he says, do one thing, stay 1 year. Don't stay any more than a year. You stay more than a year, you'll be there for the rest of your life. And I thought, oh, gee. So I was coming up to a year, and I'm sending these tapes out, and I was panicking. Well, somebody sent one of my tapes back to Denny Reed, the general manager, instead of back to me. Now Denny knows I'm looking for a job. So he's going around one way around the building. I'm going around the same way. And we finally bumped into each other. He says, aren't you happy here? And I said, you told me you could only pay me $250 a month, and that was tops. And I'm making that now. And I didn't tell him about the Bren Traff thing. So anyway, I was on my way without a job, only to end up sending tapes out and picking up a gig when they signed on CHNL and Kamloops.
You stayed there for, again, it looks like about a year.
About a year and a half, yeah.
And what was your job there?
Like I say, I left Quesnel as a morning man, and then when NL went on the air, which was a wonderful thing because we were all new. There's Dan McAllister, he was on the island now. He's a big shot suit. He was the morning man. Hap Thiessen, Larry Thiessen, he followed him at 9. And then I was doing the evening, 7 till midnight.
And what were they playing there?
It was a real mix. It was a good MOR, all the good MOR stuff. Very, very fringe rock and roll stuff at the time. And that would be, what, around 1971 or something like mm-hmm. that. Then partway through that, I got married. And when I got married, John Skelly, who was the owner and general manager, he thought that, you know, it might be an idea that a married guy should have a better shift. So I got the drive, the afternoon drive shift, which I was very excited about. And yeah, stayed there about a year and a half and had a great time there too. And we had, like I said, a lot of really fun people. Keith Hunt was there and Bob Egbie. But what happened was, I didn't know it, but Hal Davis from NW came to town and went into a motel and sat and listened to my show for a few days on the advice of, it was either Mel Cooper's brother or someone in Mel Cooper's family. They owned the Cooper Foods in Kamloops. And at a Christmas dinner, they were sitting around and Mel was saying, you know, we want to make a change at the station. They had Wally Garrett as, at that time, a very high-priced operator for Jack Webster's show, because he used to do a thing called Fiesta before Webster arrived and doing talk. So he had been around for a long time. So what they were after two announcers, for the same price as Wally Garrett, and retiring Wally and bringing in two guys to split shift the operating Webster show, do weekend record shifts, disc jockey shifts, and do traffic reports. So it was a real split shift thing. So Hal Davis contacted me after listening to the show and said, hey, you want to come and work at NW? Well, I almost fell over. That was after like a year and a half in Kamloops. Couldn't say yes fast enough. And the other guy they hired at the same time was Dave McCormick. See, he came up from California. So Dave and I were doing the same thing. We would do a weekend shift. We'd operate for Webster and do some traffic reports in the very beginning. 71 to 78 is NW, about 7 years there.
You did a variety of things during your time there. Mm-hmm. You started in the afternoon, I believe.
That was after I did the weekend split shift, operating Webster traffic thing. I think that was for about 2 years. Dave and I did that. Dave was always pegged as the successor to Jack Cullen. But then he naturally went over to the FM side and he got this documentary going and fabulous shows. What they did is they came to me and they said, how would you like to do noon to three? This was after a couple of years. I said, noon to three? I said, well, Jack Kyle's doing noon to three. They said, well, don't worry, we have something for Jack. And I was blown over. I go, oh, my God. You know. So I worried about that for a long time. Every time I bump into Jack, I didn't know if he knew or not. And, you know, it was very uncomfortable. And one day he got me in the coffee room. It was classic. And he says, hey, well, I got the word and everything, and I'll be doing, you know, the all-night show. And I said, gee, Jack, I said, you know, I didn't quite know what to say and everything. He says, don't worry. He says, it'll happen to you one day. And sure enough, it did. They're very wise words. Yeah. And the last song he played on his show was Hit the Road, Jack, because Jack was always building these musical tapestries, and he was so good at it. Cheers, customers. Yeah, so Jack, and then they invented this thing, Wayne Cox and Friends, and I had all kinds of things. I brought Errol Bradford in from the newsroom. He would read the news, but he was so good at doing kickers. So I said, Earl, why don't you be part of my little show here? And I had a clairvoyant, I had an astronomer person, I had interviews. It was a real hodgepodge. It was like Wayne Cox and Friends. And it probably was a pretty good little show, but it kind of wore you down after a while because you didn't have like a producer or a helper or anything. It was all by yourself and lining all these people up and everything and running the board and running records and the whole thing. So anyway, it was a good little show while it lasted, and it lasted a number of years. And then I got the word that they were going to go talk. And they brought in Barry Clark to do talk. And so I tried to invent a position for myself, which ended up in the sports department because Big Al Davidson was going pretty much all day long. And I said, you know, I could come in and do the evenings, and then I would tape something for FM that they would run in the morning of sports scores. And I was pretty much grasping at straws as to feed my family, is all. To be honest with you. And so and fast forward the tape to when I had an ill-fated talk show at CJOR. I'm in the men's room and the door opens and who walks in but Barry Clark. And I said, not you again. That was in the future. And sure enough, he was after me again.
1980 comes along and you leave CKNW. Was that your decision?
No. No, they suggested I find another job. And I said, oh, I'm fired, am I? And they said, no. Because I guess if they said you're fired, then there's severance.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't want to pay that. So they said, no, we just, maybe you should look around for another job. It's, oh, why, I ought to. So anyway, I lasted the 6 or 7 months, which would have amounted to the severance. You know, I would be allowed and everything. And then we just parted ways. And the very next day, I started doing weekends at WX and doing some work with Jim Murray and Marsh Fisher at a little ad agency called NMCF. And that, again, it fed the family. But I was still kept in the radio thing, which I always loved.
When you were at WX, what were you doing? Fill-in shows? Or
I did weekends, and yeah, I'd fill in if somebody was on holidays. And that time, you know, there was Jim Fraser and Bob Bye and Elmer Tippy and Weird Harold was the music guy, and Cam McCubbin was in the newsroom. It was a tremendous lineup of personalities. It really was fun, yeah.
Then you sort of took a turn into the television world. How did that come about?
Well, the very first TV exposure I had was when I was at NW, actually, and a fellow named Barry Thompson, who was the creative guy at BCTV, he called me and he said, hey, we're looking for somebody to do a commercial for a travel trailer place out in Langley. Do you want to do it? And I said, well, I've never done television before. Oh, he says, nothing to it. Come on. Boom, boom, boom. So that was sort of the first exposure. And then when I was doing the ad agency, I think I'd already done Wednesday Night Hockey. I was the host of Wednesday Night Hockey at BCTV, and that came from doing the commercial, just people in the building. And I was also filling in on the NewsHour weather for Fred Latrimo, because Latrimal was, Norm Groman had taken off to Europe or something, and so Freddie was doing it for a few years, and I would fill in for him. So I was running around, you know, 7 days a week, and Greg Douglas took me aside and said, look, he says, you know, you're going to spin your wheels, you're going to burn yourself out. Pick something and aim for it, go after it, put all your efforts there. He said, why don't you go down and try CKVU? They're looking for someone, I guess, you know, Tom Lucas had just left the Vancouver show. And they may be looking for someone. And so I went down and hounded those people. And Harvey, the late Harvey Southam, was the producer of the Vancouver show. And I did the classic, you know, phone him every day for a month. And he finally got sick and tired of the phone. So he said, well, come on and let's have a chat. Yeah, did an interview. That was my audition. He said, we were going to give, the Vancouver show is basically an interview show. So we're going to have you interview someone. I said, oh, okay. Okay, well, who is it? And they said, well, it's this woman here. 7 minutes, starting now. Sit down. And they threw the cameras on, and I had to interview her for 7 minutes. So it was the classic five W's of journalism. I just kept going through the five W's with this woman. Well, who are you? What do you do? Where are you from? Why do you do that? And who did that? And where did you, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And I went 7, 10, 12 minutes. They just kept me going. So they took, apparently, the tape up to Daryl Duke, who owned the place. And they showed him the tape, and he said, hire him. And they said, really? And I said, yeah. They said, oh, why? He says, see that interview? He's a good listener. A good interviewer is always a good listener because your next question follows up on what they just said. It's the old deal, you know, I just killed my wife. And then if your next question is, well, where did you get that nice hat? Well, you know, you weren't really listening to what the person was saying. Based on that, yeah, I filled in for Mike Winlaw and then got a regular position in the fall. Pia Chandel and I did the summer. And then, I just kept going at that and every so often would do some radio, but really didn't get back into radio until Fred Latrimo called me and when he was at KISS, when he went from CFUN to KISS and was putting a new team together with he and Kathy and one of the weather guys. So 12 years ago, maybe?
90s? Yeah. Early 90s?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. You've done a lot of different things in television. You've been a news anchor, game show host, just a general host. You've done stuff that's gone into syndication. Is that fun?
It's been great, yeah. And it's, you know, I love radio, and I've always loved radio, and some of my greatest memories of my career are radio. It's so different from television in that I always felt that in radio, especially you and I were disc jockeys, you ran the board, you did everything, you got the thing and everything. So it was totally up to you. Television, you're sitting out there, and you're relying on so many people to make sure the cameras pointed in the right direction, make sure the microphone's on, make sure the level is right, on and on it goes. So there really are two different things, but the television has been very, very good to me. And as you mentioned, game shows, talk shows, variety shows, bikini contests, beauty pageants. Esquire Barnes once said, we were sitting around, he says, is there a show you haven't done? And I had to really think about it and say, gee, I don't know. There must be something because I did, you know, hockey. I've done sports. I anchored with the news for 2 years with Doriana Temelo. So I don't know. There probably is a couple of shows I haven't done, but I can't really think of them. Yeah.
And you've done a lot of charity work as well, the annual telethons, things like that.
Yeah, we do two telethons a year here now, Children's and Variety Club. And that's always great, too. They really are meant to showcase what these charities do and give them exposure and also raise some money. And yeah, that's been good too. But over the years in television, the opportunities of the people I've been able to meet, going on movie junkets and the old Vancouver show, I mean, we would interview anyone who moved.
Tell me about some of those people that you've talked to.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was 2 hours live every night from 7 till 9 p.m. and no news component to it. It was just all either taped stories that were feature stories, but mostly they were in-studio interviews. They would go anywhere from 7 to 15 minutes. But there were, you know, people like Dustin Hoffman, all the mayors of Vancouver in the day, you know, and aldermen. And, well, I got an interview on tape that I like to look at every so often, and it's Gordon Campbell when he was an alderman for the city of Vancouver. And I was a host on the Vancouver show, and we both had dark hair. And he was saying, you know, talking about, well, maybe one day I might run for mayor, you know, these kind of things. And you look back on some of those and, Oh, we had all the great musicians that came through, B.B. King. There's just been so many. And that's the one thing TV afforded, was to meet, even if it's briefly, just for an interview, all kinds of fascinating people. And through it all, through television and radio, I just feel so blessed that I've been able to work with really the best in the industry, especially in our area, in radio. You know, Brian Forrest and Rick Honey, Art Finley, if you remember Art, and Jack Webster and Pat Burns and Big Al Davidson and all these guys. When I started out, you know, just a kid operator and thing, I just, oh my gosh. And I think it took probably about 10 or 12 years before I finally convinced myself that I had a career. Up until that point, I didn't see it as a career. It was just so much fun. Why are they even paying me anything for this? I would come in here and do this for free because I'm having such a good time. I'm working with all these giants in my mind, and I think they were giants in the industry at the time. I just felt always just so blessed that I was able to do that and make a couple of bucks along the way, you know?
This is something I hear from everyone who's been successful in this business, is that it was fun.
Yeah.
And they felt like they never did a day's work in their life.
Absolutely.
Because all it was, working with great people, meeting great people, and just having a lot of fun doing it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've run into guys sit around, you have a few beers or something. If you get a chance, you know, some old radio guys and that you worked with. And, yeah, I think you're right. Every guy will say the same thing. You know, if we did it because it was fun we couldn't even think of doing anything else. I was going to leave the industry at one point. And I'm telling you, I sat there for, it must have been a week, trying to figure out what else I would do, and I came up with nothing. I once interviewed the artist Robert Genn, West Coast artist, who has, you know, his works hanging in the National Gallery and all over the world. And I once asked him, I said, if you weren't a painter, what would you be? And he said, you mean if I wasn't a successful painter? And I said, well, yeah. He said, I'd still be a painter. I just wouldn't make any money. But that's what I do. I paint. And for so many guys, I think it's the same thing. I mean, look at Red Robinson. I mean, sure, he was in the advertising business with his partner, but he was still on the radio at the time, and he's still broadcasting, and I'm sure he still loves it. Red is there's another guy. You know, I finally, after a million years, I finally got to work with Red, and it was on a telethon, and I was thrilled. The night that Fred Latremoe and I were inducted into the BC Entertainment Hall of Fame was a huge moment for me, and for Freddie, too. We were really quite moved, you know, being a couple of Vancouver guys, for starters, and thinking that, you know, you'd have this little marker on the streets of Vancouver and a little section in the Orpheum Theater. I mean, that was overwhelming, and that was really fun.
If you had to pick one incident or one event in your career, both radio and television, that would be the highlight?
I would have to pick not just one sort of individual night or moment or interview with someone, or it would be times at NW. I really enjoyed. That was terrific. And again, for the same reasons I mentioned, working with all these people. The other one would be game show work with Talk About on CBC, and it ran down in the States. And then I think the other one was working with Fred Latremoe. Freddie is just, in my mind, just so good. When he went off the air for the second time, or was it the third? We'll have to call him and ask. I go, oh no, you know, what am I going to listen to now? And the other guy who was fabulous was, of course, Rick Honey, and I miss him a lot. Yeah, so I think I'd have to clump it into times as opposed to one particular moment. It's all been good, yeah. Yeah.
Funniest or most embarrassing moment in your career?
Well, when you see, someone asked me about the embarrassing thing, and when you worked the Vancouver show, like I say, 2 hours live every night, things went wrong all the time. You kind of got used to embarrassing moments, you know? There were just things where it has to go wrong. If it was a tape show, you could always rewind the tape and do it again. This was live every night, and so there were all kinds of things that probably I really should have written down, and I'd say, oh yeah, there was the time that, you know, they glued the cup and saucer to the guys, you know, or the time that, you know, Laurie LaPierre threw all his papers up in the air, or the time that Doug Collins stormed off and then they throw the camera on to you and you got to think of something fast and you kind of stumble through something. You go, oh boy, I hope my mother wasn't watching that one. There have been those, but most of it, it's just after a while, just, you don't, you say, oh well. You get this. I've talked to other guys and they get this too. Do you still have, even though you haven't been a disc jockey for a long time, nightmares about dead air and not being able to find a piece of copy and not being able to get the news intro cart.
I think everybody in this business has those on occasion.
Isn't that the
oddest
thing?
Or the door to the booth is locked and you can't get in.
It's been so long since I've been a disc jockey on a show. I had that nightmare 2 nights ago. Well, that's ridiculous, you know? But anyway, I throw that in just because it was one of those things nagging my brain. I'm sure other guys have the same problem, but it seems odd. Maybe it's because it meant so much to you. You put your whole heart and soul into what you were doing, and it meant a lot to be right on and doing it properly, that I guess somewhere back in the psyche, you know, there's something nagging saying, well, you know, what if the record runs out? What if you don't have something ready? You know,
I think people don't realize that every time you crack the mic or step in front of the camera, it's a performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as being on stage, being in a play, being in a movie, and you have to be on 100% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there are hundreds of other people who want your job.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, there was, who was it that said, was it Tom Brokaw? Or it was someone like that who said, you know, as far as the news and anchors and everything goes, he said it's journalism when it's in the typewriter, but it's show business when the red light goes on. I think there's a lot of that. Otherwise, why would news anchors brush their hair? They wouldn't bother, you know, or wear a nice tie or something, you know.
You mentioned a lot of names already, but some of your very favorite people with whom you've worked. You mentioned Fred Latrimoe, of course, the classic rock and roll disc jockey.
And so bright and so funny and so witty. Rick Honey is another one. The late Bob Spence, who I worked with on the Vancouver show, and he also worked CBC Radio for a number of years. Bob was a terrific guy to work with. I had lunch just the other day with Art Finley, who I always had admired. Just his style was so fantastic. Of course, he worked KGO for a number of years too. There's been so many. I've been very fortunate to work with some of the most beautiful women in broadcasting as co-hosts, just also, you know, working beside them. I mean, just in this building alone. And that's always a treat to come to work when you, like Doriana Temelo and I and Maria LaRose and I were co-hosts. Pia Chandel and I co-hosted the show. There's just been so many. And so I always have fond memories of that too.
You have been the weather guy on the most watched television newscast in the province and probably a little bit into Alberta and down south and all the rest of it. Everybody watches Global at 6. Wayne Cox is the weather guy. Had been there since part-time since 92 and then full-time since 97.
I think it's 18 years or something now, or 19 years that we...
How did the Hawaiian shirt thing get started, and how many of them do you have?
I have too many. The West Wing of the Weather Mansion is jammed with these things. But, you know, it started because they used to send me out to do the weather down to Kitts Beach a lot, in the summer especially. I thought to myself, what am I going to wear? You can't wear a shirt and tie. So I thought, well, it's a beach, blah, blah, blah. I had this really bad old Hawaiian shirt in the closet. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just throw this on. So I ended up Kitts Beach. At the time, Tony Parsons was anchoring. There's another guy I didn't mention. Boy,
how could
we
forget him?
A treat to work with him. But anyway, so he throws to me at the beach, and up I come on the screen, and he hadn't seen the shirt. What have you got on? He says. And I said, well, it's this Hawaiian shirt. Oh, no, no. This is on the air. He said, no, no, no. I say, you don't like it? No. Oh, you got to get that off. Got to get that off. So that's all I needed to hear. So the next night, I had another different one on, right? And he made a big deal of that. So I thought, well, this is kind of fun. And then one time, I just, normal shirt, and it was a really bad start to summer. And Deb Hope said to me, she said, you know, maybe if you threw on one of those Hawaiian shirts, there might be some magic, and we could turn this summer around. I said, well, maybe so. So I looked ahead to the 5-day forecast, and I saw that, well, Thursday was going to be nice. So Wednesday, I show up in a Hawaiian shirt. I said, Deb, I think you're right. I think there's some magic in these shirts. So I'll throw this shirt on and see what happens. Of course, next day was nice and sunny, right? So she made a big deal of it, and then I thought, that's it. It's comfortable, it's colorful, it's different. So I just went with it, and nobody said anything otherwise, so I just kept going, you know.
And you have people send you these things.
Mm-hmm. I got Hawaiian shirt notepads, coasters, fridge magnets. One person gave me a cookie jar in the shape of a Hawaiian shirt. Some people make and send me Hawaiian shirts. Others, they just happen to see one, they buy it, and they send it to me. The guys at Trev Dealey, Harley comes out with a sort of a summery kind of shirt. They send me one every year, so I slap that on. It's become hopefully a fun thing. That's the only reason I did it. I thought, well, it's different, it's entertaining, kind kind of, you know, hey, let's look at this goofy shirt he's got on tonight kind of thing. That's all.
Have you ever worn one more than one?
Yes. But it's I can go from 24th of May to Labor Day without repeating. So, and still have some in the closet that I just, I just don't like, right? So most times I'll get to almost Labor Day and I'll say, you know, I really like that one over there. The good thing is when you only wear it once a year and you wash it once a year, it lasts for a long time. Yeah, but they're all pretty much all Tommy Bahamas. And, you know, thank God I've got a clothing allowance or... Because they aren't cheap.
No, they're actually quite expensive these days. I can remember when you used to buy them for $2.50, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah,
anything else you'd like to throw in here that we haven't discussed?
I don't think so. I wished I hadn't started naming names of wonderful people I'd worked with. How could I possibly leave out Tony? But... now there's Chris Galis, who's arrived on the scene. And the thing you mentioned about people tuning into global, we're very, very fortunate that, you know, we have the audience base that we have. It's been incredible over the long haul. People are still there, and I think we still put out a good product. And as long as we, you know, are on top of what we're doing and we don't make anybody angry and they go away, I don't think there's much of a reason why they shouldn't stick around.
Wayne Cox, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Yeah.